If you would, grab a Bible and turn it to chapter 12 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 12. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like to follow along with us, we do have Bibles in the room that you can grab and use while you're here. They're at the back of the room besides this wall at the back underneath the light fixture switches in some baskets. Feel free just to get up and go grab one at any point over the next few minutes. Genesis chapter 12. That's where we're going to start. We're actually going to be in several other places in Genesis, but we'll get that in a minute. First of all, I just want to talk about the series of sermons we're in during this Advent season. The series of sermons are called Your Prayer Has Been Heard, and we want to celebrate the fact that, Advent acknowledges that we are dependents on God, and as a part of our dependence on God, we pray, we hope, we pursue the promises He gives to us. And we started off this series talking about God's promises. We started out in chapter 3 of Genesis. And if you're familiar with the Bible at all, you may think that's a weird spot to start to talk about the promises of God, because there's a lot of judgments, consequences that are handed down by God in Genesis chapter 3. Why? Well, because that is the chapter that narrates what happened at the fall of man, when sin entered the world, when man chose to basically leave behind God and His ways and to choose his own way forward in this world. The result was death, specifically spiritual death. But yet, in those words of Genesis chapter 3, there was also something very hopeful, and we know this by what Adam says after these consequences are described by God. He says, I'm going to name my wife and name her Eve. And she is Eve because she's a life giver. That's what Eve means. Now, that may not be weird. It may sound like something good, a good name that a husband could give his wife, the first husband could give his first wife, or the first woman as his wife. But you would not understand the context very well, having just a few verses before called her basically the reason why they were in the situation they were in. When God says, who told you you were naked? Who told you? Have you eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the one that I told you not to eat of? Adam's first reaction was, it was this woman that you put here with me. She's the reason I did that. So he passes the buck. But he didn't just pass the buck to her. He also blames God, because God is responsible for putting the woman there with him. How did he get from there, that attitude? Get through all these consequences all the way to the attitude that his wife was actually a life giver? Well, because within the scope of the consequences was also a ray of light. A ray of light that basically described a redeemer that would be coming, one that would crush the head of the serpent, the enemy of their souls. And so that message, regardless of all the consequences, that message came through loud and clear to Adam, to the point where he was excited enough to call his wife the life giver. It is through her and her progeny, all those who would come after, that the redeemer will come from. She's the life giver. So God made promises in these early verses of Genesis. When Adam and Eve, when we most needed good news, when at the hopeless depths of our brokenness, God cracked the door open for Adam and Eve. He cracked the door open for you and I. He showed us enough light that we would respond to God's promises and not our condition. See, that's what Adam did. Instead of responding to his condition, he chose to respond instead to God's promises. And so in an Advent, we, you and I, get to reflect on the state of our lives, the state of the world we live in, and we get to cry out to God. A part of Advent's theme is the idea of crying out to God, and He hears our cry, and He answers our cry for hope. He answers our cry for hope. You see, the same promises He gave to our first ancestors, Adam and Eve, He delivers on. He delivers on them in the birth of Jesus. And so Advent is a time to trust God's promises, to believe in God's promises more than what seems like the hopeless condition of the world around us. This is truly good news for you and I when we are tempted to give way to cynicism and despair, We need not give way to cynicism and despair, because in the coming of Jesus, not only was God answering his promise of a redeemer, but the promise is still right now, here in this place, today, very much in play, because the world is still not yet the place that God said he would restore it to. He talked about the new heavens and the new earth, and it is not yet restored to that. And so there is still something yet to come. And so we still pray, we still hope in the promises of God. There is an advent still to come. We call it the second advent, where Jesus will establish the new heavens and earth and a redeemed creation where all the brokenness that you and I feel in the world we live in, the world we interact with, all that brokenness ends. It goes away. All things sad end. And there's more than just what God promised to Adam and Eve. There's more than just what we read in chapter 3 of Genesis. In fact, Genesis sets the table for the whole first portion of the Bible, the Old Testament. You see, going into chapter 12 of Genesis, there is another critical historical moment that affects nearly the entire history of what we call the Old Testament. And if you're new to the Bible, the Old Testament is just the early portion of our Bibles. And so this passage we're getting into today affects almost all of the Old Testament that we would read through. And it is this critical historical moment that shows us yet another picture of good news that we celebrate during the Advent season. Another way in which God hears and answers our prayers. Something we're focusing on during this season. And so if the first week we dealt with God's promises, they move us from despair and cynicism. Instead, they move us to hope. If that is what we would focus on for this week, we focus on a little more of what the promise is in its worked out form. What does it look like for God's promises to actually find their way into our world to touch our lives? Well, that's an interesting question that we're actually going to read a lot about in these verses. But I'm wondering, before we get into it, how do you respond to promises that are given to you? Whether it's by God, maybe you've come upon some promises in the Scriptures. How do you respond to promises given to you? Do you try and help promises along? Every once in a while, I'll buy multiple boxes or half gallons of ice cream for my kids for dessert. Stick them in the refrigerator. My kids are nosy, so they are always sticking their heads in the fridge and the freezer. And so inevitably, one of them finds them and realizes what's happened. They're like, dessert tonight. And then inevitably, I just wait for it. I know it's coming. We're nearly done with our meal. And one of them usually pipes in and goes, so do we get dessert? Do we get ice cream tonight? And I'll usually say, yeah. And I'll usually provide some conditions. I say, yeah, we're going to have to finish our meal first, and you're going to have to eat your vegetables. And then we're going to have to clean up. And you got chores involved in that. And then they're like just excited. They're just so frantic over the fact that they got ice cream that they can't think about all they need to do in between then and actually eating the ice cream. And so one child usually will grab the ice cream out of the freezer, set it out when not everyone is even done with their food. And I'm like, well, so what are you doing there? And inevitably that child will go, well, I'm letting it soften for a bit. Yeah, right. Trying to get out of what's got to happen. Wants to act on those promises right now. The promises are in my time, not in her time or his time. And sometimes kids don't understand that, right? They get a promise and they want to act on it. You tell them, you promise them some sort of activity or some sort of prize of some sort, and they're asking, so can I have it now? Can I have it now? We're always trying to push what we're promised into the present anytime we possibly can. Sometimes we even do it in an entitlement sense. We demand it. In the present. So, as we go through these verses, it's really important for you to think about that. How do you respond to promises? How do you respond to promises? All right, let's look at chapter 12. We're going to start reading there. It says, now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. Now, if you don't know who Abram is, he eventually goes by the name Abraham. His wife's name is Sarai in this passage. She eventually goes by Sarah. This is the Abraham and Sarah of the Scriptures, if you're familiar with those two people. All right? Now at this point in the Scripture, they're still going by Abram and Sarai, so we're going to see that used a lot. in this text, and he's incredibly critical to the people of God. He is considered the father of the people of God. All right? So that's Abram, really big, important figure both in Israelite history and in church history. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you. And I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. So, this is an interesting promise. It's made even more interesting if you have a little piece of information that is mentioned in the preceding verses in chapter 11. Go to verse 30 of chapter 11. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. That's the Bible's way of saying they were struggling with infertility. They could not have children. So this is the condition. And he takes someone who is in that condition and says, I will make your name great. I will give you generations. I will give you children. And so they're hearing this against the backdrop of a brokenness in their situation, where they were in life, the reality that they had dealt with most of their life. Now, to understand this passage and subsequent passages, if you were to go forward to chapter 15, you don't have to go there, but chapter 15, Abram is doing what a lot of us do, doubting a little bit about how God is going to do everything he says he's going to do, because he says, I still have no heir. My heir is going to be my nephew. And so God says, no, that's not true. It's not going to be anyone but your child. And then he goes a step further, and he says in verse 5 of chapter 15, he brought him outside, and he told him, look towards the heaven, number the stars, if you are able to number them. Then God said to him, so shall your offspring be. And then really critical words in this particular narrative in verse 6. He believed the Lord, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now, if we go fast forward into what we call the New Testament, the back portion of our scriptures, we learn quickly that what Abraham was doing in that moment in believing God, in it being credited to him as righteousness, was he was believing the gospel. The Bible tells us that that promise that he was believing was in fact the gospel message said to another time, another place, to another people. And so this is a critical moment of belief that Abraham has. And to understand a bit of the situation that Abraham finds himself in, you actually got to understand it against the backdrop of chapters 4 through 11. So let's go through a little bit of chapters 4 through 11. I just want to give a survey of it. I don't want to read everything. So go back to chapter 4, flip back just a few pages to the story of Cain and Abel. If you were in the 10:30 service last week, I gave a little bit of a recount of the story of Cain and Abel, and we even talked about how when we live being under a promise, we either live in the way of Cain or the way of Abel. The way of Abel is the way of believing the promise. The way of Cain is the way of not believing the promise. And so we go back to this passage, and in case you missed some of the details of what was transpiring here, at some point along the way in human history, men and women started worshiping the Lord in tangible ways, offering sacrifices early back to Adam and Eve and their children. And so it says in verse 1 of chapter 4, Adam knew his wife Eve, she conceived, she bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again, she bore his brother, Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, Cain a worker of the field, of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and their fat portions. Now these are two perfectly acceptable offerings, both of them. One is not superior to the other because one's a blood offering and the other one's a grain offering. That's not really what the passage is getting at this point. In fact, there was probably not a developed understanding of different types of offerings. These were both good offerings, which makes the next statement even more difficult on some level to wrestle with. He says, in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the first of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. He had no regard. We're not really told why. We can surmise some things from what's said down below, but what it ultimately has to come down to, it has to come down to Abel offered his offering in faith, believing God's promises. Cain offered his as a sense of achievement, of doing something, not believing in the grace giving of God's promises on his behalf. And then it continues on. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry?" His face fell. And he says, "Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted?" And well is defined by trusting the Lord, by trusting the Lord, not distrusting the Lord. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. He's saying not believing the Lord, not taking his promise at his word, is the same thing as opening yourself up to a volley of attacks by the enemy of your soul. He says sin is crouching. It is waiting for you to disbelieve God. It is at the door, and it looks to, and its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Then Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and he killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he says, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And he goes on to say, "What have you done? His blood cries out from the ground, and that same ground is going to be difficult for you. It will not yield what it's yielded to you to this point." And he goes on with some consequences that are very similar to the types of consequences we read in Genesis chapter 3. And by the end of it, we have this picture that's very grim, very grim. One of the only children that is born of Adam and Eve, Cain, who still survives, is now living under some severe consequences for the remainder of his days. And we get a picture that his family, his descendants, will actually walk in the ways of Cain and continue to pass along evil and distrust of the Lord. So much so that God's plan for marriage, one man, one wife for one lifetime, does not take too long to get off track when it says that Lamech, one of his descendants, took two wives. And such was the beginning of polygamy. And then it's obviously all throughout the Bible from then on. But here was the beginning point. We first see this transpiring. We think all hope is lost, but it's not. It's not. Chapter 20, or verse 25 of chapter 4 says, "Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and called his name Seth. For she said, 'God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him.' And to Seth also was born a son, and he called his name Enosh." And this is really important, this next verse. "At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord." What that means is what we're focusing on during these weeks of Advent, your prayer has been heard. Prayers began to be uttered in the name of God's promises in this time of Seth. Seth was the beginning of a new generation, a new opportunity. Much like Adam and Eve, his parents received a new opportunity outside of the Garden of Eden. Now he would be representative of a new opportunity, of a new people that would eventually lead to Noah and then Jesus, and would be the beginning of all of the people of God. And so he begins this new era, and the scriptures go on in chapter 5 to talk about his descendants, and they talk about his descendants going all the way down to Noah. And then in verse 1 of chapter 6, it goes on saying, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land," and when it says when man began to multiply on the face of the land, he's actually saying, you know, doing everything we just recounted in chapter 5, these genealogies. And so really what this is in chapter 6, it's kind of going back to the beginning of chapter 5. Chapter 5 is recounting all the generations that were produced, the multiple progeny that came out of the line of Seth, and ultimately we also have seen the line of Cain. And he says, "When man began to multiply in the way that has just been described, and daughters were born to these men, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive." They were attracted to women. Men and women were attracted to one another. And so what they did is they took as their wives any they chose. Now, we don't know exactly what this is getting at, but from the next verse, we take it that this is a continuation of the sense of people taking multiple wives in these generations. They were taking multiple wives, having multiple children from multiple wives, really just growing the population, being fruitful and multiplying, but in a way that God had not designed. And it says in verse 3, "Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man or for man forever, for he is flesh." And all that means is, because he's flesh, he's susceptible to sin, this is going to continue on the same cycle over and over. His days shall be 120 years. That doesn't mean he should live 120 years. That means there's 120 years more left before I'm going to do something about that. And what is that? The flood. Okay? So 120 years is his life. And then it says in verse 4, "The Nephilim were on the earth in these days and also afterwards when the sons of God came into the daughters of man and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown." Well, that's a provocative verse, isn't it? I mean, what does that mean? Truth is, we don't know. We don't know, and I think speculation's probably pretty unhealthy at this point in something like this. What we do know is that the original readers of this, which were the Israelites coming out of the Exodus, the original readers of this apparently didn't need any explanation. They knew who the Nephilim were. That has been lost to us within antiquity. We don't know. We know that something having to do with them or maybe their offspring were large and giant-like. We don't really know. All we know, these were men of old, the men of renown. And then it continues on saying, "The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." It's the Bible's way of saying evil was just running amok. It was just running out of control. And then it says in verse 7, "So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them." Again, pretty grim, right? Really grim leading into the flood. But there's always a but. This is what happened in chapter 3. It's also what happened in chapter 4. But Noah, who was amongst the population, found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. And if you're familiar with the story, and if you're not a big deal, I'm going to just recount the highlights of it. The story goes something like this. God says, "Noah, you found favor, you and your sons' wives, their children. And we need a set of animals, one or two by two. You need to make an ark. You need to put them in there. And you need to do that because you need to survive a flood that's coming, a flood that's going to completely wipe out the current population that has gone to wickedness to the extreme in this world." And so he obeys the Lord. He does this. The rains came. The earth was purged of all the humanity with the exception of Noah and his three sons, their wives, and their children. And they arrive on dry land eventually. And so Noah and his generations end up being the ones who end up populating the earth. And so they populate the earth, and the nations are descended from Noah, the Bible says. At that point, there's a new covenant, new agreement made with all of humanity, not just the people of God, but with all of humanity. They will not destroy humanity in the way that he has just destroyed it as in terms of a flood. Never will he do it again. The rainbow will be a symbol of his promise that he will not do it again. And so there we see in chapter 10 yet another list of genealogies, descendants from Noah. And again, this is meant to get us through the many multiple generations. Here man is doing it again. He is multiplying. He is filling the earth. He is doing what he was meant to do. He's not always doing what he was meant to do in the ways that God meant him to do it, but he is still multiplying and filling or populating the earth. And then we get to chapter 11. And chapter 11 really is meant to take us back in time, probably near the beginning of all these genealogies, or at least at some point in these genealogies, we're not really sure. And it gives us a story from within all of what he has talked about in these genealogies, and it goes like this. "The whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Now, spoiler alert, I'll go to the end of the story. Basically, God says, no, you're not. He confused their language, and he spread them out throughout the earth. We're not really sure for sure on this, but this seems to be the scriptural explanation for the multiple nations and peoples of the world and the multiple nations that have comprised the many languages of our world for as long as we have record or can remember. And so whatever it was, we do know that through these verses leading up to chapter 12, there is a picture being painted, a picture being painted of mankind and how he responds to the promise of God. And his response oftentimes looks a lot like my children's response to being aware that there is ice cream in the freezer. They try to hurry God along and try to make a way for the promises of God to be made on their own, basically working furiously to do things that they were never meant to do. And I want to give you three reasons why these verses are important to understanding chapter 12 and the call of Abram. And I'm going to lace them in and out with what I have to say about Abram and his situation and how his situation was completely different and has really an impact on us during this Advent season. First thing, there was a theme of greatness and favor that people had pursued in these passages. We see it oftentimes. We saw it just there at the end in Babel. We saw them wanting to make a name for themselves, wanting to be great, a great people. But we also see it as far back as Cain and Abel. You see, when Cain and Abel brought their offerings to the Lord, and he accepted and regarded Abel's offering but did not regard Cain's offering, in that moment, Cain did not feel great. He did not feel favored. Now, this is the situation humans find themselves in on this side of Eden, on this side of the fall, on this side of sin. In and of ourselves, divorced from God, we are not great. We are not great, and we are not favored outside of God's grace and intervention. But yet, we know we were meant to be. And we know from Genesis chapter 3 that there is something in those promises that promise favorability and greatness for us again. And it will be by means of a Redeemer. But yet, like my children, they did not want to wait for God's plan. And so they would try to make their own way. You know how Cain did it? Cain did it by violence, by power. The power of violence. How did he do it? He killed his brother. What did killing his brother achieve? Well, let me cut it down to real simple terms. If it's you and another person, and you're getting picked for two teams, and there's the good team and the bad team, and you know that you're the worst person in the room, the best way for you to get picked for the good team is to get rid of the best person. And that's basically what happened. He elevated his favorability, his greatness, even though he was not favorable and great, he elevated by getting rid of the competition. And so he believed, this is what we do though, folks. What do you do? What do you do when you are feeling the tug of not being great, the tug of not being in favor? Let me put it in other terms. When you feel great guilt, great shame over who you are or what you've done, have you ever been in a situation where maybe you have siblings growing up, and your sibling is commended for something they do? So-and-so did great at school. Good job. Or they did a good deed within the household, and mom or dad just compliments them and goes on, man, I'm so proud of you. And you're the sibling listening to that, and you go, well, I did this. I know none of you have kids who do that like my kids, right? Yeah. I did this. So what that she did that? So what he did that? I did this. Or better, you think that's so big? Let me tell you what she was doing 5 minutes before that. What are we doing? What are we doing, folks? We learned this at an early age. We are feeling our disfavor. We are feeling the weight of the fall. We are feeling that we are in shame and guilt, and so we destroy anyone who would somehow call to attention our shame and guilt because we perceive them to be better than us. We tear people down. I don't have to get into this. You know this. Facebook is a veritable playground of wickedness in tearing people down. Oh, so many self-esteems are built upon how other people are torn down because it elevates me. It means one less person to be at the top of the pile. This is what Cain was doing. Now, if you go fast forward to the Babel experience, they were not trying to achieve greatness or favor by way of violence. They were trying to achieve favor and greatness by way of achievement, by doing great things, by working hard, by their efforts, their furious efforts. And God says, that's not how you're going to get things done. That's not what my promise was meant to give to you. So you work harder now. That's not the nature of grace. I want you to contrast those two things, the pursuit of power and the violence of power to achieve favor and greatness, or just using plain old achievement, and compare that to Abram's situation as we find him in chapter 12. God wants him to go to a land that is not his own, a land that we will soon learn if we were to forward in time and read the rest of Abraham's story, we would know that he is truly a powerless man in this new land. He's powerless because your greatest power, your greatest shield, your greatest defense in a sometimes brutal and violent world was your tribe, your clan, your family. And God specifically sent him away without his family. Oh, sure, he had his nephew Lot, his wife, but he sent him primarily alone. He did not have his tribe. He did not have his clan. He had no defense. He was truly defenseless. He was truly dependent upon the favorability, the kindness of others in Canaan. What an amazing place to be in to receive the promises of God and to receive them with faith. He didn't have options. He didn't have achievements he could try to achieve. He didn't have power he could use and exact on other people. He had none of this. And so when the gospel came knocking, the gospel of the promise of God, I will make you a great nation. I will make you a great people. I will do good things for you. He is in a position that we should just desperately want to be in, of need, because it is in that desperate point of need that we can actually say yes to God's favor, yes to God's mercy. Furthermore, if we go back throughout these passages, especially before the flood, the passages about people before the flood, they lived just ridiculous amounts of time compared to the lives we live in today's world. There are a lot of theories for that. I won't get into them. But we think that there's something of a line drawn between the flood, since the flood and before the flood, something that enabled human beings to live longer. Again, not going to get into all the details of it, but that's the gist of what we see. We start to see less lifespan after the flood. And so all the people leading up to Noah and eventually leading up to Abram had all this time to do all these things. They had enough time to build a tower that could possibly reach so high that one could say it's reaching the heavens. It just seemed like endless time in their lives. What would you do with 900 years of life? I mean, can you imagine? Can you even imagine the capability? They had a lot of time to get things right, didn't they? A lot of times to get things right. A lot of times to do things and to get things wrong. Whereas here's Abram in a foreign land with foreign people, no family, no clan. Not only does he have fewer years having been on this side of the flood, but get this, when his story starts, he's already old man. He's already an old man. And so his years are almost already gone in the way we would think about our years being gone. His life's nearly over. And that's when his story begins. So he hasn't had the kind of years that others have to kind of achieve, because the years sometimes will give us the illusion that we have all the time in the world to do things we never really can do without God. And so he doesn't have the luxury of time. And then we also see a theme within these passages, especially the genealogies are trying to get this across, of just rabid fertility and multiplication of peoples. Additional wives create additional multiplication of children. They were very fruitful. Again, not always in the ways that God wanted them to be fruitful, but they were extremely fruitful and they populated the earth. We see that, and then we are introduced to Abram, who is what? Without child and in an infertile marriage. Again, you can't get as opposite of what we've read chapter 4 through 11. The story of man at this point is actually extremely opposite of Abram's story. But yet it is that story, that piece of history, where God begins to not only reinitiate his promise that we were called to have hope in, but now he's going to show us, he's going to start working out the promise in actual real life terms. And he takes Abram, a powerless one, one who does not have all the time in the world, one who does not, in natural terms, even have the ability to reproduce. And he says, I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you a great nation. It's going to be such a great nation that it's going to be where you look in the stars, so will your descendants be. All he had at that point is trust. Otherwise, he would do what we said the way of Cain is cynicism, despair. All he had at this moment is trust. And this is why I think it's significant in chapter 15, that verse we read where he was having that doubt again, it says he believed God, it was credited to him as righteousness. Because he realized he cannot build a tower high enough. He cannot have enough children, and he can't have enough time to do anything that is pleasing to God. That he is completely dependent and hopeful in a promise that God would do something for him. In fact, in each of these areas that we just went through, there is one consistent message with this critical moment in history. God takes the initiative. Did you notice that? The one grand difference between Abram and his world and the world of all who came before him, we recounted, is that they took the promise of God as a cue for them to take the initiative and hurry God along. Even Abram was susceptible to it. We know as his story goes on that he had to go to Egypt because of a famine in the land of Canaan. And that when he was in Egypt, he knew he was in trouble because he's a man alone without a family, without a clan, with a beautiful wife. And that the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, would recognize she's beautiful. And since he was the husband, he would off him and take her to be a wife in his harem. And so he chose to lie to Pharaoh. He said, oh, no, she's not my wife. She's my sister. Hoping that he would spare his life and take his wife in to be one of his wives. And this is what the king of Egypt did. This was him trying to hurry God's promises along. Then he does it again, or they do it again, when Sarai recognizes they still don't have a kid and no kid in sight. She gets for her husband Tamar. And she gives him to, or Hagar, and gives him to Abraham. Say, you take her, she'll produce a child for you. Gave him a concubine. And God said, no. But again, even Abram is susceptible to trying to take God's promises and hurry them along and to do what he ought not do. Because you see, Advent, friends, is not only about hope in the promise God gave. Advent is about waiting, too. Did you know that? If you ever see any themes about Advent, hope is definitely huge. But so is waiting. Well, waiting on what? Waiting upon the one who must take the initiative with us, who must come to us. We just sang the song, did we not, folks? Do we not sing the song, "He has come to us, Jesus"? The reason why that song is so significant is because we can't go to him. We can't come to him. We can't meet him halfway on his promise. We need him not only to make the promise that we put hope in, we need him to deliver on the promise. He has to come to us. So in Advent, we celebrate God coming to us. God takes the initiative. He must come to us. And so men and women of God would seek the Lord to come to be a significant presence and help to them. And this is the gospel's message to us during Advent, specifically today. We, you and I, we won't celebrate or feel the weight of Jesus' coming to us unless we have come to an end of ourselves and into our efforts to hurry along God's plan in our world. What do you need to wait on the Lord for in your world? What is Advent bidding you to wait on the Lord for him to come? I always need him to come. We are responders. We're not catalysts. We are responders to God's initiative. We do not create our own opportunities or act as our own redemptive agents. We need Jesus to come today during this Advent season just as much as we needed him come last year or yesterday. He has come to us. Is that good news to you this morning? It will only be good news if you've come to an end of any kind of lie you believe that you can somehow go to him. Let's pray. Father,